One, two, three. Go.
Welcome back to QAV episode 715, the 9th of April 2024. You had another bloody birthday last week, TK. I can't keep track of your birthdays. I swear to God you have like three a year.
Well, I adopt the convention of having them on the same date every year, so you can put it in your diary.
I have multiple times, and it never reminds me. Somebody posted, I think it was Cosman, posted happy birthday to you on Facebook, and my initial thought was, ah, what are you doing, Cosman? That's not his bloody birthday. And then I looked at the date, and I was like, 4th of April. See, that sounds right.
Yeah, 4th of the 4th. Just remember that.
Happy birthday. What did you do?
Thank you. Well, I've just got back from Wagga. I went down to Wagga for 4 days and hung out with Ruddy and had a break from Sydney, and it was raining cats and dogs when I left, and it's raining again when I'm back. So we played a couple of days of golf, watched the races, bet like crazy on anything that was happening, which was a lot of fun. And I actually had a birthday tipple. I took a bottle of scotch down and managed to have, I think, three nips of scotch, which will do me for another year.
Three nips?
Three nips, yep.
Were the nips getting bigger?
They could have. They could have easily gotten out of hand, but no, they didn't. I got to that nice sort of warm feeling, you know, that nice warm feeling, relaxed feeling, and you start to think, wow, if I feel this good after three sips, how am I going to feel after half the bottle? But I went, no, don't be silly. So, yeah, that was good. Good fun, good break. Nice and relaxing. Ruddy's a great host.
That's good. Did you any of your bets win?
Nah, but didn't lose much. It was a big race day in Sydney, Doncaster Mile Day. So I think I lost about $100 betting on the races there. And then I had so Ruddy and I just watched the golf and put $5 on different players and frayed our fortunes and stuff. And I had $5 on this guy the night before the final round. He finished up running second, but I thought it was 6-1, and I thought, gee, he could win this. He's a much better player than the guy who's leading. And he made up all the ground, got to a playoff, and then hit the ball in the water on the first playoff hole. There's one good thing about punting is you always find a new way to lose money.
Well, speaking of losing money, Tony, China stumbles.
Share market's up today. What are you talking about?
No, I'm not going to get straight into the share market. That's boring. It's too boring these days. It's just up. It's nothing going on.
Yeah,
it did slide back a little bit last week, but nothing major. We've been talking a lot about China, and in my research on China's economy, I stumbled on the IMF's website over the last week, International Monetary Fund, IMF.org. There was an article posted December 23 by Yaswa S. Prasad. Don't know who he is, but he's writing on the IMF's website. It says, growth slows, risks abound, but economic and financial collapse can be avoided. China's economic performance has been stellar over the past three decades, with remarkable and persistent high growth that lifted the economy from low income to upper middle income status, blah-de-blah-de-blah. China has been the main driver of the world's economic growth, accounting for 35% of global nominal GDP growth, while the United States accounted for 27% over the last decade and a half, this is. But basically, he's saying detractors have long argued that China's economic collapse was imminent, pointing to numerous fragilities. Country's growth has been powered by investment in physical capital, especially real estate, that has been financed by an inefficient banking system. Still not really sure what that means, an inefficient banking system. With domestic debt levels high and rising, the property market unraveling and the labor force shrinking, some analysts say the day of reckoning has finally arrived. But then he says they are likely wrong. Unbalanced reforms that have kept the institutional structure weak, a schizophrenic approach to the role of the market versus that of the state, and strains in financial and property markets could result in significant volatility in coming years. But none of this means a financial or economic collapse is inevitable. And his summary at the end is the underpinnings. Oh, hold on. He's a professor at the Dyson School at Cornell University, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and author of The Future of Money. So that's his cred.
Is the Dyson Institute, is that like a vacuum cleaner?
Yeah, they make vacuum cleaners and air conditioners.
It's the Godfrey's Institute.
It might have been funded by him.
Yeah.
The Charles H. Dyson.
Probably be Freeman. It'd be Freeman Dyson. Oh, it's not Freeman Dyson.
The Charles H. Dyson School of Applied Economics and Management. Charles H. Dyson was an American businessman and philanthropist, the founder of the Dyson Kistner Moran Corporation and the Dyson Foundation. Not sure what they did. Hold on. Here we go. The Dyson Corp. No, no Wikipedia link for that. That's because it's changed its name. Nothing for that either. So I don't know what they did. Anyway, he died in 1997.
Yeah.
Back to this article. The summary at the end is the underpinnings of China's growth seem fragile from historical and analytical perspectives. Even if no crises materialize, unfavorable demographics, high debt levels, and an inefficient financial system will constrain China's growth. Yet, if the government plays its cards right, one could equally well envision a more benign future for the Chinese economy with moderate growth that is more sustainable from an economic, social, and environmental perspective. So I thought it was a more sort of positive outlook coming from the IMF, of all places, for the future of China's economy than anything I've read in the Australian media in the last 5 years.
Yeah, well, it was a very two bob each way article, isn't it? It may crash or it may not. Is the summary.
Wow. He is an economist after all.
Yeah, exactly. I'm trying to find a quote. It's a quite long article and I can't find it now on the fly, but there was a quote in there about how economists tend not to like China or China's future because it's not a democracy and it's not doesn't have a market economy and a few other things that they look for as indicators of a solid and prosperous economy. And I'm thinking, yeah, you're not going to find a better or more solid and prosperous economy than China over the last 20 or 30 years. So, I think the economists have got it wrong there about democracy and free markets. I mean, he makes a very good point that we're in a centrally managed economy. They're very well placed to bolster the sectors that need bolstering and regulate the sectors that need regulating.
Yeah.
They've had a very long track record of growth. So I wouldn't be betting against them. And I guess the reason why it's of interest to us is because China is such a big trading partner for us. And, you know, they were about a month away, we'll get a budget handed down, and I'm fairly certain it'll be bolstered by coal royalties and iron ore royalties, iron ore in particular, through trading with China. So China's economy is important to us. But I remember through my investing career, there was a very bullish sentiment towards China maybe 20 years ago when it was growing at even double-digit per annum increases. And then it slowed down a bit and you started to see people posting photographs of apartment towers where no one lived in and, roads to nowhere and all that kind of stuff. But I was always fairly skeptical of that ad hoc sort of analysis of the Chinese economy because it's such a big place with such a big population that if there's a couple of disused highways, it's not going to make a skerrick of difference to the economy. Mm. And the numbers have always been consistently good. Sure, they're slowing down now, but balancing that is the fact that there's, you know, they brought so many people out of poverty into middle class lifestyles, and that's got to be good for the economy going forward. Won't grow as fast, but it'll still grow. And, you know, one of the things that China seems to be doing well is to balance that, being the sweatshop for the world and transitioning from there to being a services-based economy, in areas like IT, for example. So,
And also one of the big pushes over there at the moment is to move towards self-sufficiency. So
it is everywhere.
Yeah. That's probably decoupling thing that we keep hearing about.
Exactly. Yeah. They probably wouldn't be pushing that if America wasn't pushing it first.
Yeah, possibly. But I do think, you know, they're cognizant of the fact that they need an economy which doesn't survive on exporting, you know, being the world's manufacturer, the world's sweatshop, you know, that they need to be able to run off the basis of a domestic economy to a large extent, domestic consumption. Anyway, so interesting. You know, it's like I've said on this show, and we talk about this on the Bullshit Filter all the time, just the level of skepticism and cynicism about China that's in the Australian media is overwhelming. It's just wall-to-wall skepticism, and it's really hard to take seriously. So interesting that the IMF is writing something a little bit less cynical. But speaking of cynical...
I mean, there is really a dichotomy in public life about China, isn't there? On the one hand, it's our biggest trading partner, and we should be treating it like a good, you know, good customer. And on the other hand, we're doing AUKUS deals to have nuclear submarines in case the customer turns against us. I don't think people can get their heads around that, really.
It's straight out of that episode of Utopia.
Right? Yeah.
We're gearing up to go to war with our biggest trading partner.
Yeah, we need to protect Asian trade routes. And what would be the most dominant one that we need to protect? I can't say.
How about I say it and you just nod? Would it be China?
Yeah,
such a great scene.
Yeah.
Speaking of cynicism, I saw this and it just cracked me up. I love this. This is Barry Diller. I mean. Like, gee, Barry, what can you say about Barry Diller? His career, he's sort of been everywhere.
In the media scope, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and not really known as a softie. Not really, he was not what I'd call a softy lefty Republican by any means. But
as some of my friends like to say, a woke snowflake.
Yes. you know, he ran Fox for a long time and QVC and God, whatever else. I've even lost
wasn't
track.
Wasn't he involved in
Paramount?
Disney? I think he ran Paramount. Yeah.
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 I saw this interview with him recently talking about Trump Social or whatever, Truth Social, Media's thing. Hopefully you can hear this. Shake your head if you can't hear this when I click now.
Not a political question about former President Trump, but actually a business question about Truth Social. You've seen this stock on the move in this, I'll call it remarkable, maybe even crazy way.
Just say two words, GameStop.
GameStop. That's what you think is going on here.
It's ridiculous. The company has no revenue.
But do you think it could ever be a bigger business? Do you think if he wins the presidency, it becomes...
Why?
I'm asking...
Why would it be bigger? Look, he's only interesting now because he's out there entertaining the folks. I hope if he does get elected, he just plays golf for 4 years. But
so do you think that all of the investors in this are getting scammed? Do you think they think this is a transference of wealth from one side to the other? And that's the goal. What do you think is happening?
I think they're dopes. I mean, who would buy a company that literally has, I mean, I think, what does it have? $30 of revenue? How could you put a value on it? They're buying it for other reasons, just like they bought theaters when there was no theater business, or they bought GameStop or whatever. It's stupid. It's stupid stuff.
It was 1,000 times revenue.
What?
It was four. Was it 4 million? It was
$4 million in revenue. That's $4 million. It's ridiculous. I'm not saying it's not reality.
$4 million.
Why are you even talking about this? It's a scam. Just like everything he's ever been involved in is some sort of con.
Well, it's refreshing to hear someone say something straight up and down in public, isn't it?
It is, yes. Particularly a guy like Barry Diller, who, you know, as I said, worked at Fox, all those sorts of things. But, yeah, I thought that was great. It's a scam. Yeah. It's a con. Why? And where's the value? It's not making any money. I don't know. Just get Barry Diller on the show.
Yeah. I love the line that if he gets elected, I hope he plays golf for 4 years.
Yeah, well, he will, no doubt. But,
yeah, true.
Among screwing other stuff up.
Yeah, that was funny. Well,
Lindsay,
I mean, Truth Social, that's hard to say. Truth Social was merged in, backdoor listed into another company. basically so Trump could pay his bond to be able to keep living in Trump Tower in Fifth Avenue. So it had to work from that point of view. But yeah, I doubt if it's got any real legs as a media empire.
Tony, I saw this, made me laugh too. The president of the Federal Reserve in, Minneapolis or somewhere? He says, he was being interviewed recently. You've already said on record that you have an unlimited supply of dollars. Doesn't it make sense to trade some of them in for a currency with a hard cap? Jennifer Ablan, editor-in-chief of Pensions and Investments, asked this guy, Kashkari, during a LinkedIn Live event on behalf of an audience member and referring to Bitcoin's fixed supply of 21 million Bitcoin. What is that hard cap? Kashkari, the president of the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis, responded. The hard cap could be zero for Bitcoin. It could go down to zero. Just replace the word Bitcoin with Beanie Babies. Should the Fed buy Beanie Babies because Beanie Babies were a fad for a while? For Bitcoin's hard cap of 21 million to be changed, it would require a majority of Bitcoin miners who maintain the network in exchange for Bitcoin to vote for a change. This would fork the network, with the minority of miners continuing to maintain the Bitcoin with a 21 million hard cap. Kashkari said that, like Beanie Babies, Bitcoin has, quote, no actual utility in the economy other than being a nice toy that some people enjoy owning and trading, end quote, adding that the only use for Bitcoin is, quote, trying to subvert banking regulations, get around either marijuana banking or illicit activities. Bitcoin, he says, has been around for more than a decade, and more than a decade later, there's still no legitimate use case in an advanced democracy. Warning, there's a lot of fraud, hype, and confusion, so I am worried from a consumer perspective.
Well, the use case is fraud, money laundering, and
it's not a bug, it's a feature.
What they were.
Yes.
Yeah, very, very good analogy. It is exactly like that, isn't it? Just like when Nike brings out a limited release number of sneakers, it's just like Bitcoin. There's only 21 million, or whatever it is, $21 billion worth of it. Get in quick. Yeah. It's the same, exactly the same.
Start buying Nikes.
Yeah. What was that? That was part of the influence book, that there's a marketing premium to having a limited edition of things.
Yeah.
Mm.
Which is a good time to announce limited edition QAV memberships. We're only ever allowing 500. So get yours today before the price goes up or something.
Good. I've got a pulled pork to talk about next, if that's okay.
Who are you pulling today, Tony?
I'm pulling A1M, AIC Mines, code A1M, which I thought was an interesting code. Another Barry and Stan idea to put a numeric into the code. I guess it differentiates them from A2 Milk, but this is a mining company, a copper miner, copper gold miner, although I don't think they've got any gold yet, but certainly selling copper. So on the buy list, it's a WA. Well, it's actually headquartered in WA, but their mine's in Queensland, so, and they're all over Australia, so it might just be like where their sort of headquarters is. Formerly called Intrepid Mines, and they merged with another company in about 2019 to become A1M. Their largest mine and their producing mine is called Eloise Copper, and it's near Mount Isa in Queensland, and it sells copper concentrate. But they do have another 7 exploration projects across most states in Australia. They acquired Eloise in 2021 and have since successfully explored in the area to just about, well, probably more than double mineral reserves. So they're very much in growth mode, this company, not paying a dividend because of that, and pouring a lot of money into capital expenditure to try and grow around the company. That paid off for them in Eloise's case because there's a proposed mine called Jericho in the same area, and it's at the funding stage. So again, this company is another example of a bit like Karoon that may raise money to help fund its growth. Although I think in terms of Jericho, they're talking about taking on debt and potentially even debt funding for from customers of the copper offtake when the mine goes into production, which is not an unusual way to fund mines in the sector. I've got to say the copper price is increasing, so it's a buy on the commodity graph. And the company points out that this is being driven by increasing needs for copper in the production of wind turbines, battery storage units, EVs, solar panels, and in just generally upgrading the electricity transmission network, oftentimes needed to get access to the grid from wind turbines or other sort of new facilities. Gold price is also doing well, but at this stage, I couldn't see anything in their numbers that suggested they were actually had much or any gold sales to speak of. It seems to be all copper concentrate from the Eloise mine. But it's been spectacularly growing. Latest results show that sales are up 58% and profit is up 143%. And it actually turned a profit this half from a loss last time. So looks like they're doing well. It seems like they've been able to fund all of their capital needs, even for that big exploration program of seven different sites around Australia and expanding Eloise. They're funding it from cash flow. I guess that's a great thing. The downside is that, of course, it means that they're not having, even though they've turned profitable, that they're not making much profit. And so their PE is quite high. And to run through the numbers, I'm going to use a share price of 37.5 cents. The company has an ADT of 122,000 on average. So large-ish, but it may not suit big investors, but might suit a lot of people anyway at that sort of level. Interestingly enough, this is a company where the share price is only almost half the consensus forecast. So the brokers think there's plenty of upside in the share price. But we don't. IV1 is 2 cents, IV2 is 18 cents. So not on an IV basis will we buy this company. However, the IV is going to be driven by earnings per share, and a lot of those earnings are used to fund mine upgrades and exploration, so it's understandable. The company has no yield. Stock Doctor Financial Health and Trend is strong and steady, so that's good. Anyone interested in ROE would not look at this company because it's only 1%, but again, that's driven by the earnings being ploughed back into CapEx. PE is 102, which scores us a minus one, and that is because, as I said, it's the cash is flowing in, but it's flowing out in terms of CapEx for exploration, not to the bottom line. PropCap, however, is 4.75 times, so there is plenty of cash coming in through the front door, and it seems to be judiciously used if sales have jumped by 58% in the last half. NEPS, net equity per share, is 34 cents, and if we add 30% to that, 44 cents, it means we can buy this company for less than book plus 30%. So that's probably how the market's valuing this. It's market's understanding that profit is being eaten away with growth, but the assets are there and it's trading around book plus 30. Forecast earnings per share is really good. It's the growth of nearly over 400%, which means our metric that we like to score these on, growth over PE, is 4.05 times when we're looking for a good company to have at least 1.5. So we score it well there. A company which has, I guess you could call it an owner-founder. It hasn't been in existence for that long, but there are two people on the board. The chair, Joseph L. Raghi, holds 8%. Sorry, there are more than two people on the board, but there are two who have large shareholdings. Joseph L. Raghi, the chair, holds 8%. And there's a director called Jonathan Young, who is associated with a fund manager called FMR Investments, and FMR holds 17.8%. So between those two, the directors hold 26% of the company. So we'll score it for an owner-founder. It's been a recent second buy line cross, but it's actually been a buy for quite a while. Other manual entered data, no consensus, consistently increasing equity. So we can't score it for that, and the PE is quite high, so we're not scoring it. It's actually scoring a negative as being the highest in the last 3 years. So all in all, the quality score for this stock is 11 out of 15, or 73%, And the QAB score is 0.15, so it's kind of in the middle of our buy list. But if people are interested in specy miners, this one seems to be well run. And that leads me into my positives and negatives. Positives was the you would expect there'd be a fair bit of upside from new mine development. Exploration is progressing at Eloise/Jericho. There's a couple of other promising projects, one in Charters Tower called Towers called the Pyramid Project, another one called Delamarian near Broken Hill. However, they are seeking to divest two of their current projects, Mary Mia and Lemille, which suggests that they don't get everything right. So this is the kind of stock that will go up and down based on releases of how much resources are under the ground for these kinds of exploration projects. And it'll also go up and down as new mines come online. So something to be aware of. It's these companies tend to be driven by news and can be a bit specky because who knows what's under the ground until they drill the holes and get a fair idea of what the resource levels are themselves. The negatives for a stock like this is that successful projects will require funding. So it's one thing to find copper underground, but you've got to get it out. And so that will mean either an increase in debt for the company or potential financial raisings from shareholders in the future. However, this company, at least to date, has seems to have a very good management track record of navigating their way through that. And the last negative that we should highlight is potential commodity risk. So copper's looking good now, gold's looking good now, but with a one or two commodity type miner, they will turn down when the commodity prices turn down. So that's, A1M.
A1M, and the copper price is looking good. Gets driven by all sorts of things, right?
Oh, yeah. Not the least of which is new mines coming into production, as we saw with lithium. One of the reasons why it went through a great run and then a great fall was because there weren't many lithium mines in production and then the whole heap came online all at once.
Yeah, right. Mm. And obviously copper's very big in electronic vehicle and as well as construction,
batteries,
all sorts of things.
Yeah.
Batteries, yeah, lots of things driving it. And difficult to mine too, I believe. It's difficult. Takes a long time to get a copper mine online. And there's lots of problems with some of the existing ones, aging infrastructure.
Okay.
Places like Chile and Peru often have geopolitical tensions. They got some big copper belts in those countries, which can affect the price. Anywho. Thank you, Tony. A1M, not a milk company. That's the
no. That's line. A2M.
Yeah.
Yeah. A1 and A2. Different.
Not the milk. Copper and milk go together like chocolate and
B1
fish.
And B2. Yeah.
And that's the end of the free episode of QAV for this week. If you're a new listener, I just should let you know how this works. So we have a free episode every week, runs for about half an hour. We have a premium episode also every week. It goes for another 30 to 60 minutes, depending on how many questions we get. Where Tony answers questions from our club members. If you want to check out the premium episodes and all the other benefits of being a QAV club member, which is access to the checklist and the Bible and the private Facebook groups and the other comms channels that we have, invites to the dinners, Zoom calls, etc., etc., just sign up for the 2-week free trial and check all that stuff out. You can do that at QAVpodcast.com.au. Look for the free trial button there. And if you like the idea of value investing QAV style, but don't feel like you have the time or resources to learn how to do QAV for yourself, think about signing up for QAV Lite. That's our relatively new service where we send you the stock tips every week. And then we also monitor those stocks in a portfolio. And if they become a sell, we email our QAV Lite members and tell them that it's time to sell that stock and what to replace it with, check that out too. It's sort of a low effort way of doing QAV. Still better if you know how to do it yourself, I think, because Tony could get hit by a bus and then where are you? But while he's not, we can do this. So check that out, qavpodcast.com.au/light, LIGHT. If you don't want to sign up to any of those, just keep listening to the free episode. And if you have any questions, shoot me an email. You'll find that on our website too. All right, have a great week and good luck with your investing.
The QAV podcast is a production of Spacecraft Publishing Proprietary Limited, authorised representative of AFSL 520442, AFS representative number 001292718. Please don't make any investment decisions based solely on listening to this podcast. This is presented as general advice only, not personal financial advice. We don't know your personal financial circumstances. Please see a financial planner before making any investing decisions.